If you're a minister of religion, you've signed up for a tough gig. You'll encounter anger and grief. But it's unlikely you'll be prepared for what the Melbourne minister, Christy Buckingham, experienced 2 years ago.
I will never forget them. I've never seen or ever walked people to their certain death singing the praises of God. I've never seen people express such courage, such forgiveness, and such kindness in such a powerful and tangible way.
I'm Andrew West. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. 2 years after walking with Australians Andrew Chan and Mayuran Sukumaran to their executions in Bali, Christy Buckingham steps up the campaign to end the death penalty. And is Brexit an echo of the English Reformation that tried to drive Catholicism from the sceptred isle?
I don't underestimate the extent to which Brexit has appealed at a subconscious level to a Protestant island myth of nationhood as defending Protestant England from Catholic Europe. And I have no doubt that if Britain were a more Catholic place, then we would have been less likely to have had Brexit.
Austin Ivory on the religious undertone to Brexit and how Prince Charles has become the great religious healer. Andrew Chan and Mayuran Sukumaran were two Australian drug traffickers, but by all accounts they were totally reformed, committed to spending their lives in Indonesian jails trying to reform other criminals. Mayuran became an acclaimed artist, Andrew an ordained minister. But 2 years ago this weekend, they were executed by firing squad. Pastors Christy and Rob Buckingham of Melbourne's Bayside Church walked with Andrew and Mayuran as they prepared to die. Christy Buckingham is back in Bali this week, determined to end the death penalty everywhere, this time with the help of young filmmakers.
Thank you, Andrew. Lovely to be with you.
Christy, 2 years after the executions of Andrew and Mayuran, can I ask what the feeling is inside Kerabakan prison?
Yes, well, as a matter of fact, yesterday being Anzac Day was the day that they were given their 72-hour notice, and that was such a unbelievable day. Obviously, the prisoners are still not recovered or even been able to fully grieve the loss of these two men, simply because life inside prison is about living each day. The legacy that Andrew and Mayu have left in terms of leadership has been fantastic, but these guys were friends of many people inside the prison, including the guards. So the loss is very felt and very felt this week.
Yeah. Can I ask you personally, because you and your husband Rob became great spiritual partners to both Andrew and Mayuran. Can I ask how you are both feeling on this second anniversary?
Firstly, Andrew, thank you for that compliment, but I would like to say that there were many people that were part of Andrew and Mayu's journey. I just feel this incredible sense of loss, an unbelievable sense of waste, and I will admit some anger, because President Jokowi talked about and does talk about his war against drugs, and he killed two of his greatest weapons. Had there been courage there to allow the boys to go into different prisons and start up other programs so that it would have stopped others who were going to be released turning to crime again, that would have been the way to go. So there's this great sense of still being confused, confounded by the total lack of any consideration for what is happening worldwide in relation to the death penalty, and any recognition that the fact is that it is not a deterrent against drugs.
Yeah. Can I just ask you, Christy, if you could recall just those last couple of hours that you spent with the boys?
Yes, I will never forget them, personally. I have never seen, obviously as a pastor and as a minister and as a person growing up in Northern Ireland and seeing many fatalities as a course of life, I don't think I've ever seen anything so profound. I've never seen or ever walked people to their certain death singing the praises of God. I've never seen people express such courage, such forgiveness, and such kindness in such a powerful and tangible way in the midst of such horror. And I would like to take this opportunity, Andrew, of thanking people around the world for their prayers, because they were certainly felt by the boys and by myself and the other spiritual directors. There is absolutely no question that in the midst of that horror and that horrendous act, that God was very close. Mm-hmm.
And we should remember, of course, that Andrew Chan became an ordained minister, which was, I guess, something added to the impact of what happened to him in a way, don't you think?
Absolutely. And Andrew, even on the night of his execution, I remember with great distinction hearing the chains of the men walk in the pitch darkness. And for the first moment, my heart sank because I heard them as the world saw them as condemned men. And out of the darkness, Andrew sang a song, "Savior, You Can Move the Mountains." And Andrew was just an incredible individual. I remember saying to him one day, "Andrew, this must get on top of you." And he said, "Well, when it gets on top of me, instead of me telling God how big my problems are, I tell my problems how big my God is." And that's Andrew in a nutshell.
One way, of course, to keep alive not just the memory of Andrew and Myuran, but the cause that you and Rob have dedicated yourselves to, of fighting the death penalty, is through a movie that's being produced, Execution Island. The producers are looking to crowdfund this movie. What are you trying to do with that movie, Christy?
Well, there's a couple of things. It's a very real fact. I mean, there's two movies being produced at the moment. A documentary that is really based on Mayu's art and his legacy, and that as an argument against the death penalty. It's a hybrid documentary, and that is called Guilty. And that's talking about the actual area of rehabilitation. The other one is the film called Execution Island, which is being produced by Three Kings Pictures, is talking about basically how faith, not only faith, but your values can see you to the end. And I think it's a real encouragement to know that Mayu's family was a Christian family. And Mayu in particular, I remember saying to him, you know, he said, "Everything's coming back. All the songs I learned, all the things," he said, "it's all coming back." And he said it was like having a box of things put aside that you didn't use for a while, and then you brought out and you remembered them dearly. And Mayu was a deep thinker, and he was into philosophy and also just really engaged in deep conversations about faith. And so the movie will talk about how their faith kept them and their family strong. And like I say, there were many people involved in that faith journey, and they were model prisoners, as the guards described them, and they certainly have got a lot to say in relation to you have control over yourself, even though you don't have control over your environment.
And just finally, have you kept in touch with the families?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, I was speaking to Mayu's mother just yesterday. She, in particular, you know, is getting strength out of the fact that knowing that we are all doing what we can to speak up against the death penalty in 2017, killing people on purpose instead of, you know, reasonable prison sentences, is just no longer something we even need to consider.
The Reverend Christy Buckingham, she and her husband, the Reverend Rob Buckingham of Melbourne's Bayside Church, walked with Andrew Chan and Myuran Sukumaran in their last years before they were executed 2 years ago in Bali. Christy, thank you for being with us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Wonderful to speak with you.
And there's a link to that crowdfunding website on our homepage at the RN website. Now, you might recall our recent interview with Professor Ian Benson about religious freedom and the same-sex marriage debate. Ian's delivering the Acton Lecture on Faith and Freedom at the Centre for Independent Studies next week, and there's a link to that on our website. This week, Pope Francis goes to Egypt, only the second time a pope has visited the land that 2,000 years ago welcomed its most famous refugees, Jesus and his family. Alas, Egypt today is less open to religious minorities. The Pope's visit comes amid a spate of attacks on the Coptic Christian churches. Francis will meet his Coptic counterpart, Pope Tewodros. He'll also meet the Grand Imam of the Al-Azhar Mosque in Cairo, a key part of reconciliation with Islam. Australian journalist Walt Curnow is in Cairo.
Pope Francis's visit to Egypt later this week is incredibly significant. I mean, not only for the Coptic community who have faced so many recent attacks in the last couple of weeks. His message so far has been one of peace and unity. And it's also important for the Egyptian state, including President Sisi. He has made a point since coming to power in 2014 that Christians are equal and they are brothers. President Sisi was actually also the first Egyptian president ever to visit a Christmas mass in 2014. Which was seen as very significant and as an act of solidarity.
Now, Walt, not only a couple of weeks ago did we have two attacks on Palm Sunday on Coptic churches, more recently we've had an attack on St. Catherine's Monastery. What is the feeling on the ground now among the Coptic community, even further besieged?
The attempted attack on St. Catherine's Monastery was significant in the sense that it's in an area which has been very well protected up until very recently. It certainly was an attempt to further scare the Coptic community. I mean, one police officer was killed. This is a really significant site for Coptic Christians. So for someone to make an attack on this is certainly trying to put fear into the Coptic community even more, especially that it's in the lead up to Pope Francis's visit later this week.
Do we know if this latest attack on St. Catherine's is part of a series of planned attacks designed to deter Pope Francis from visiting?
If we needed to speculate, I would definitely say yes. I mean, as this is such a significant holy site, it really is an attempt to make it look like the situation on the ground in Egypt is less secure. This is a very secure area. It's also a very popular tourist site. So if they could come here, it makes it look like they are capable of attacking in many other places in Egypt too.
Yes, we know that El-Sisi has also been to the Vatican, but is he going to leverage this politically? Because with the attacks on the Coptic churches, there's a lot of, well, resignation within the Christian community that he can't really protect them anymore.
I think this is why Sisi would like Pope Francis to come to Egypt. I mean, President Sisi has been criticized widely by foreign governments and human rights groups for human rights abuses. So with someone as popular as Pope Francis coming, someone who is seen as a man of peace, for Sisi to have a photo opportunity with him, to have a conversation with him, I think it's going to give Sisi more legitimacy, not only with foreign governments, but also with his own population in Egypt.
Although we are seeing some cracks in the Coptic community's support for El-Sisi, aren't we? I think a lot of Copts on the ground are becoming very despondent.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Actually, an interesting example when this became most apparent was in the attack on the Coptic cathedral in Cairo in December last year. There was actually quite a big group outside the church chanting slogans against the government and against the state and against the security forces because of their lack of protection. So, I mean, certainly there are younger members in the Coptic community as well as others who have really become quite fed up with what they see as the state's neglect of their community.
Now, just finally, Walt, what is the significance of Pope Francis meeting the head of the Al-Azhar Mosque? Because the Al-Azhar Mosque in Cairo is considered one of the world centres of Islamic scholarship.
It's very important because the Sheikh of Al-Azhar is one of the most significant Muslim figures in the world. So for Pope Francis to visit him and for them to have a meeting, it really stresses unity between the two religions.
Yes, meeting Sheikh Ahmed Al-Tayyib, who, as you say, is the Grand Imam of the Al-Azhar Mosque, is very symbolic. Is it likely, though, to have any effect on the ground where, you know, religious hostility is just escalating?
It's difficult to say how it could have much effect on the ground. I think Al-Azhar and also the Coptic Church, as we've been saying, are aligned with the state. They haven't accepted much dissent. So on the ground, it probably won't make all that much difference.
Journalist Walt Curnow in Cairo. And you're with Andrew West on RN, Radio Australia, ABC News, online and on your favourite podcast app. Well, the Pope has been a busy man this week meeting President El-Sisi in Egypt. A couple of weeks ago, he was with the Prince of Wales in the Vatican. But hosting Prince Charles wasn't just some sort of diplomatic courtesy. It was a meeting of minds. Both men are very worried about the environment and religious violence and poverty. And the leader of Catholicism and the next head of the Anglican Church are determined to get along despite Britain's decision to Brexit the European Union. Austin Ivory is a commentator and author of The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. Does he think the future King Charles will be a radical bridge builder between the faiths?
Well, I think he has great credentials in that regard. He's spoken up often for Muslims, on behalf of Muslims in Britain. He's very, very keenly aware of some of the pressures that they are under. And he's done his best, I think, in his role as prince to be a bridge builder between the different faith communities in Britain. I think people were very struck in the Thought for the Day, which is a slot on our main morning programme, Today programme, just before Christmas. He gave a kind of Christmas Thought for the Day. And he spoke at the birth of our Lord Jesus Christ and recalling that Mary and Joseph were fleeing violent persecution. And he added, we might also remember that when the Prophet Muhammad migrated from Mecca to Medina, he was seeking the freedom for himself and his followers to worship. The way he linked those two was very, very striking, offended some people, but I think a sign of his capacity actually to seek parallels between the faiths and to build understanding between them.
He has taken indeed some very concrete steps. Has he not funded a centre for the study of Islam at Oxford University?
He has, that's right. Also, he's very, very keenly aware of the plight of refugees in Iraq and Syria and has done his best. He's put pressure on the British government to accept more. Again, you know, it's persecuted Christians in the Middle East he cares deeply about, as well as Muslims persecuted also by Islamic fundamentalism. He doesn't make the mistake, in other words, of believing that the victims of Islamic fundamentalism are only Christians, because they're not. They're mainly Muslims. That's a point he's made a number of times.
His one blind spot here, though, Austin, is that Charles is very friendly with the Saudi monarchy. And Saudi Arabia, as you well know, is the incubator of some of the worst forms of Islamic terrorism. How does this square with Charles's efforts to be a bridge builder?
Well, you know, I think there's Prince Charles, the bridge builder between the faiths, and then there's also Prince Charles, who actually acts on behalf of the British state. Actually, the whole British state's relationship with Saudi Arabia is deeply questionable in a way, but I mean, because of the very, very tight links between the two countries, you think about the arms trade, you think about the oil imports and so on, is a very, very dense relationship there, and he's clearly part of that. The defence that the British government makes of maintaining those relationships is that they can exert influence, And no doubt Prince Charles would say the same. In other words, the fact that he has those meetings with the Saudi royal family, he would say, enables him to raise issues of concern, and it's better to have that relationship than not to have it.
Yeah. Did I read, Austin, where Donald Trump, on his expected visit to the UK, he wants all the trappings of a royal reception, but apparently he doesn't want to meet Prince Charles because he says he doesn't want an earful, an ear bashing about climate change and relations with the Muslim world.
Yes, I read that too. But this is one of Charles's great passions, as you know, is the environment. And Charles actually was talking about ecology and the environment long before it became mainstream. He's been quite prophetic in that regard. He's strongly influenced by a man called Lawrence van der Post, who was a kind of guru figure for the young Charles. Van der Post has written a lot about ecology. So yes, I think Trump has a kind of horror of Prince Charles, because everything Trump represents, you know, Charles doesn't, and vice versa. And I think Charles will be quite glad, I suspect, that Trump doesn't want to meet him.
Yeah. Now, you wrote a very interesting essay in a recent edition of Crux, which is a magazine that covers the Catholic world, and it was about Charles's meeting with Pope Francis. What do Prince Charles and Pope Francis have in common?
I mean, they have an obvious shared passion in bridge building between faiths. Ecology, obviously, I mean, nobody doubted that in their 27 meeting, they didn't talk about that. Of course they did. That's a shared passion. Pope Francis issued his famous encyclical Laudato Si on the care of the common home in 2015. Now, there's another interesting point in common that they both have there, which is that Laudato Si, the ecology encyclical, actually quoted Orthodox tradition. The Orthodox have long cared about the environment. Now, the Orthodox Church actually is the church, I think, that Charles most closely identified with, even though of course he's Anglican, but actually I think Greek Orthodoxy is where his passion is. And of course that's in the family. He's got an Orthodox monastic tradition in the form of his Russian great aunts who were converts to Orthodoxy. He had a grandmother who was an Orthodox nun, and his father, Prince Philip, maintained links with the Greek church even after he of course converted to Anglicanism to marry the then Princess Elizabeth. But Charles himself, he's been, for example, a number of times to Mount Athos, which is the kind of the spiritual centre of Greek Orthodoxy. Anybody who goes to his country retreat at Highgrove notes that, you know, there are Byzantine icons there, that he's been visited there also by one of the Orthodox abbots and so on. And Pope Francis has a very particular link and relationship with the Orthodox. And I think, you know, nobody knows what went on in that meeting. I think Orthodoxy would have come up between them, I think.
Yes, interesting to point out, though, that when you go to Mount Athos, I think it is a place where women aren't allowed. This is the Greek Orthodox monasteries set up on those magnificent cliff tops in northern Greece. I think they are off limits to women, though.
I think you're right. I don't think Camilla would have ever had gone with him. But, you know, Andrew, you know, men all need their shed at the end of the garden. Maybe Mount Athos is Prince Charles's garden shed.
Yeah, quite a shed. And, of course, he does have this tension, though, because he did famously say 20 years ago, "I wouldn't mind being a defender of faith." Faith plural. Now, that doesn't mean he's going to change the coronation oath. How's that going to fit with, of course, his constitutional task as Supreme Governor of the Church of England?
Well, this is where I think there is real tension, because he wondered aloud whether, in fact, he didn't want to be considered defender of the faith, but rather of faiths, meaning the defender of, if you like, the principle of religion, the rights of religion, all religions, not just that of Protestant Christianity. But the reason that his remarks were greeted with great dismay from more conservative establishment quarters is precisely what you've just said. The King, the Queen of England, is also the Supreme Governor of the Church of England. And even though the nomination of bishops is delegated to the Prime Minister of the day, nonetheless, that is a role that constitutionally belongs to the monarch. And actually, if you stand back and you think, well, what actually is English identity? What is English nationalism? It really does rest on this idea of a Protestant island nation that is defending itself from the threat of Catholicism. Now, okay, that's a different era. That's no longer how people see the world. But once you start taking that away and you start to unravel the link between the monarchy and the Church of England and the state, then you begin to get into quite sort of dangerous territory. And that's why people actually were nervous about it. Now, he's since clarified that, you know, he wasn't seeking to change the coronation oath, but rather he says, in fact, that coronation oath isn't to defend Anglicanism at the exclusion of other religions, but rather the free practice of all faiths. So he's clearly saying, I will be a traditional Anglican, I will take on that role, but I will interpret it, as has my mother, actually, has meaning also at the service of all faiths. But he is different from his mother, as I pointed out in the article, in that the Queen is quite a devoted low church Protestant, and he's much more of a kind of an Anglican with a strong interest in the Orthodox monastic tradition. I get the sense that he will broaden out the religious role of the monarchy as king.
One of the many fascinating points that you made in this piece in Crux, and we'll put a link to it on our website, is that 500 years on from the Protestant Reformation, Brexit has some very strange echoes of the Reformation. How is that?
Well, it is fascinating to look at the historical parallels, and a number of historians have been writing about them. But I was also very struck not long ago in the Times, Michael Gove, who was really the leading Brexiteer in the Conservative government, was writing about how Theresa May, our Prime Minister, had given up crisps for Lent, and that this showed actually that she was a bit of an Anglo-Catholic. And can an Anglo-Catholic be entirely trusted with Brexit, given that Anglo-Catholics have always looked to Rome? And it was actually a very serious essay. I mean, he was actually trying to support Theresa May and saying, no, there is no contradiction. But how interesting that he had to kind of point that out. I don't underestimate the extent to which Brexit has appealed at a subconscious level to a Protestant island myth of nationhood as defending Protestant England from Catholic Europe. Well, we should never underestimate how much these religious values underpin what appear to be rational, self-interested values. I don't think the people that voted Brexit were doing it out of a visceral distrust of the Pope. Although Francis has strongly criticised the direction of the European Union, the Catholic Church is, if you like, one of the main backers of the principle of the European Union. And I have no doubt that if Britain were a more Catholic place, then we would have been less likely to have had Brexit. And the point I was making in the piece is actually the prince, or the future King Charles, in committing himself, if you like, to the global faiths of which a religiously diverse Britain is part, I think could be an interesting bridge, in a way, to have a monarchy to counter some of those isolationist, self-referential pressures which I think are building up now and which Brexit is giving expression to.
And Charles and Francis both also criticize this purely technocratic view of the world. They both do seem to share a kind of underlying feeling that there are mysteries and there are questions that are important in our lives, and that not everything can be explained through this sort of technocratic view of the world.
I think that's absolutely spot on. I think this is where they really do share a lot in common. I mean, Charles is actually quite a mystic in his own way, in a very English, upper-class kind of way, but he is. Spirituality is important to him. So much of his message in his speeches is exactly, let's not downplay or undervalue the spiritual component of our lives. Let's not live, if you like, in the purely material, because then we're cutting ourselves off from the source of our life and our being. Pope Francis' great thing in Laudato Si about actually restoring our connection with God is the same as restoring our connection to the earth, and caring for the poor and caring for the earth are really part of the same. That's what comes with our relationship with God. In many ways, both Prince Charles and Pope Francis are, one might say, two of the leading figures in the world who spurn the idea that everything can be reduced to reason and money and functionality. And in that sense, they are both considerable spiritual figures for our technocratic age.
Spiritual brethren, indeed. Austin Ivory is a British journalist and commentator. He's the author of The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope, a revised edition out now. Austin, thanks again for being with us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you, Andrew. Nice to be with you.
And that is the program for this week. You can download our interviews from our homepage at the RN website and do subscribe to the podcast. Thanks to producer Nadiet El-Ghorli and sound engineer Tim Jenkins. Our executive producer is Jane Jeffs. I'm Andrew West. Back next week.